Okay, so we talked so much in this class about testing and measuring and testing, and then figuring out what works and doing more of it. And so we're going to dive into today is the actual metrics behind that measuring, right? How do you get that data? How do customers give it to us? How do you access it? And then how do you make that data meaningful? So today we'll just look at these three points, which is one, how we are tracked as consumers, how businesses can access that data, and then three, how to make that data meaningful and how to use it to make business decisions. So we'll start, and there's handouts or slides for you guys. So let's start with the question of how it is that we're tracked. Most of the data collection that companies do on us these days is voluntarily given to them by us, right? So I just read this interesting book called Data and Goliath. It's actually where I got much of this part of the lecture. And in that book, he calls data the exhaust of the information age, right? So if you think about the exhaust of the industrial age being carbon dioxide, data is the exhaust of the information age. And so much of what is out there on us is stuff that we've put out there as consumers. So let's just start with the most basic tracking device of all, which is our phone. So how many of you have a smartphone, right? Okay, so almost all of you, I think all of you. Well, let me just tell you, nobody knows you better than your phone. Like, there's no person on earth who knows you better than your phone. Your phone even knows you better than you know yourself, right? Because first of all, well, of course it knows who you call, which is so secondary to what else it knows about you. But we do still call it a phone, even though it's really just a computer that can make calls. But it tracks you all day long. So through cellular data, through your provider like AT&T or Verizon, it knows where you live, it knows where you work, it knows the route that you take between those two places, it knows where you spend your weekends and evenings. It knows if and how often and for how long you go to church or temple or mosque. It knows specifically which one you go to. It knows how much time you spend in bars. It knows how much time you spend in the library and the ratio between the two. It knows who you're sleeping with, or at least next to, right? So it probably knows more about your love life than some of your friends even do, right? It also can track who you are spending time with, because it tracks all of our phones. And so it knows who you live with. It knows who you're in class with. It knows who you spend your time with. And this is just from the cell phone data, which is available, you know, to Verizon or AT&T, US Cellular, whoever your provider is. And this, it knows whether or not you speed, right? It can track your speed in a car. And this is just by nature of us having a phone. We're tracked that way. And that's why, you know, law enforcement will often ask for cellular records when they're putting together evidence for a case. But when you combine that with the GPS function of a phone, which is where we actually have to give permission to an app to track us, things become even more powerful. So like Google Maps or Uber or Yelp, all of those are apps that we give permission to track us because it provides a better service for us, right? You can't use Uber if your car doesn't know where to pick you up. But there are other apps like Angry Birds that ask you to use your location data, and they do it just so that they can collect it and sell it. And that's one of their revenue generators, right? And so a lot of times, the data that we're collecting or that we're handing over voluntarily is with the intent from the person who's collecting it to sell it. So when you think about it, just our phone, right? You might say, well, you know, that's not a big deal, okay? So it knows a lot about me, but it's a phone, right? Like, and Verizon doesn't care. I'm, you know, as some people say, if you haven't done anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about, right? And but you can actually tell quite a bit about a person from the data of just their phone calls, right? So if we take it even a step back to simpler, who are you calling and when, you can tell a lot about a person's life. So there was an experiment out of Stanford University that collected Meta phone data from, and Meta phone data is basically who you called and when. So it isn't specifically the conversation, but just who you called and when. So they examined the Metaphone data of 500 volunteers who let them be tracked or who allowed themselves to be tracked for the experiment over several months. And it just monitors people's cell phones, or excuse me, phone calls, nothing else. So I'm going to give you these profiles of real people from the experiment. You'll start to see when you put this data together what, you know, kind of meaning you can derive from it. So, okay, the first person, person A, was somebody who communicated with multiple local neurology groups, a specialty pharmacy, a rare condition management service, and a hotline for a pharmaceutical used solely to treat relapsing multiple sclerosis. Person B had a long early morning conversation with her sister. 2 days later, she placed a series of calls to the local Planned Parenthood location. She placed brief additional calls 2 weeks later and made a final call about a month after. Person C, in a span of just 3 weeks, had contacted a home improvement store, locksmiths, a hydroponics dealer, and a head shop. So we can make some inferences about what's going on in these people's lives, right? Person A is suffering from multiple sclerosis, right? Maybe it's a new diagnosis, maybe it's something they've had for a while, but certainly something very personal. Person B is someone who just had an abortion, right? And person C is someone who just started growing weed at home, right? And so that in itself isn't, okay, so it does tell us a story, but imagine the power if you start to pair that phone data with location data. And you can say, okay, what did this guy, what head shop did he visit? And then you combine maybe credit card data, right? And you say, okay, what did he buy at the head shop? What did he buy at Home Depot or whatever home improvement store it was? And then you combine it with public record data, like how much energy has he used and is there a spike in it in the last month, right? In fact, I know this from a real estate class I took when I was a graduate student here. The number one way cops bust home growers for weed is by looking at their energy records, because it's like normal person, pew, normal, you know, and then they just see this huge spike in energy use because of the grow lights. So be smart. Get off the grid if you're growing weed at home. And you live in a state where it's still illegal. All right. So anyway, like I said, there's all of these different places that collect data, and one data set alone, like who we make a phone call to, isn't really extraordinarily meaningful. But the real data or the real value is when we kind of start to connect these. So imagine if those phone calls that I just outlined were matched with GPS data, and that alone would tell you a lot more or confirm your suspicions. So some of the other places we give data are a phone. I mentioned that. There's search data on us. Anything you put into Google is kept by Google. If you have a Gmail account, they also are collecting information about your emails, the content of your emails, because they target you based on what's in those emails with ads. So Google has a tremendous amount of data on us as well. We know that from previous classes. There's cloud computing. So think about all of the things you keep in the cloud. Now, I've moved everything that I do on the computer to the cloud, and that includes a lot of really personal information, including tax information, personal finance, that type of thing. There are definitely guidelines around how this information can be used, but it's still out there, right? It's still available. And a lot of times people won't read terms of services of apps or programs they're using, so we don't really know how it's being used. There's credit card information for each credit card, but also stores collect information about our purchases. That, you know, a loyalty program collects information about when you shop, what you buy, how often you come, that type of thing as well. There's the app GPS data, like I mentioned. There's public records, so you know, real estate purchases, marriage, or a change of address forms, right? That's still public. It's owned by the federal or the post office, which is federal. Marriage records, birth records, death records, divorce records, if you buy a house, if you get in trouble with the law, right? There's all of that is public. I don't know if you guys have ever used CCAP to stalk your Wisconsin friends and family, see who's getting DUIs and speeding tickets, but you can do that. You can do that for some afternoon fun if you want. It's all public. So there's that. Social media also knows a tremendous amount about us. And again, this is stuff that we hand over voluntarily. Facebook is an incredible data collector. So just as an illustration of that, in 2011, an Austrian law student named Max Schrems demanded that Facebook give him every piece of data they had about him. And in the European Union, this is part of the law, right? It's covered under EU law that a company has to let a consumer know what they know about them. The US has no such law, right? So Facebook took him to court. They refused to give it to him. They eventually lost. And so 2 years later, they gave Max a CD with a PDF on it. So this was clearly 2011 CD, right? I don't know how they would give it to me today. But anyway, it was a PDF. It was 1,200 pages long. And it had not only his profile, all of his friends' profiles that he could see, all the items in his news feed, but also all of the photos and pages he'd ever clicked on or looked at, all the advertising he'd ever viewed. And even though Facebook doesn't use all of this data, it's just much easier for them to collect it than it is to decide what to collect. So they just collect all of it, and they just keep it all. And actually, there's studies that show that Facebook can just from your likes alone, like the things that you click like on, can predict with astounding accuracy your race, your personality, your sexual orientation, your political ideology, your relationship status, and whether or not you use drugs, just based on what you like, right? So it's an incredible amount. And when they start to put that data together with some of these other things, that's where it becomes really valuable. We're seeing this new personal monitoring trend like Fitbits, right? And again, this is data that we are voluntarily giving a company about our pulse, our health data, how far we walk, that type of thing, how many calories we burn, how much we weigh. And so you can imagine when you combine it with other data sets, the power in that. So one note about retail. I mentioned the credit cards and loyalty programs, but retailers, that data is actually alone very powerful. So I'm sure by now most of you have heard the story about Target and the pregnant teenager. In 2012, a dad called Target and he was like, "You are sending my teenager coupons and promotions for items that have to do with for pregnant women and new moms. Like, this is totally inappropriate. Please stop it." And Target apologized, but then it was only a matter of time until he realized his daughter was in fact pregnant, and Target knew before he did. And Target still does that. They since kind of that, I guess you could call it a scandal, but since that time, they've just changed the way that they market. They no longer send like just exclusively pregnancy and new mom flyers to you as a new mom because you would feel like maybe creeped out. But they couch it in flyers for around the house, but they'll put mostly baby items in there. Yeah, I'm sure there's terms of service that govern how they use that information, but they still do have it, right? So you're doing it for yourself, but Fitbit has all of that, and I'm not sure how specifically with Fitbit if they can. It would depend on the terms of service, which none of us ever read. But somebody, a hacker, could get it, right? I mean, so it is still out there, I guess. Oh, that's a really good point. I mean, I think we've seen companies can change their terms of service like that, and what little control we have over it. As I was putting together this lecture, actually, that sort of same thought crossed my mind. And I was like, okay, so I know some people in my life who smoke cigarettes. I won't call them out, but I was like, I need to tell them to start paying cash for cigarettes because I just know, like in 10 years, insurance companies are going to look at credit card records and they're going to be like, we're going to deny your life insurance because you told us you didn't smoke, and here you are buying cigarettes every week, right? I mean, I just know that's going to happen. So that mental note. Yeah.
And also, this is a kind of a side note, but I went to this homelessness talk lecture, and they're talking about how a smartphone is someone who's homeless, like the most important thing in their life because they carry around and has all their documents, like all this information and everything. And so with them having that, that's another way to track information for people that we never thought like could be tracked.
Right. That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, so many of us have smartphones and use it in very different ways, but actually all in the same way, right? So it's really interesting. So, early in the semester, we talked about the publicness versus private privacy debate or tension, and I focused a lot on the benefits of publicness because overall my sentiment lies there, and I think that a lot of good comes from this, but this is the flip side, right? This is like the creepy stalker big brother that is watching us whether or not we want them to. Well, we've given them permission to. And you can imagine this book that I'm reading is like really a downer, but it's like talking about, you can imagine how governments or rogue groups could misuse some of this data as well. But okay, so what other things? Oh, retailers are also using this GPS data to track how we shop. We've talked about this, but like they can use a combination of your MAC address and your Bluetooth ID, which is broadcast by your smartphone, to see how you walk through their store and figure out which aisles you walk down, where you stop. That, I think, some businesses are already using to send you coupons, so it's not that big of news to us. But then there's also geofencing is kind of another iteration of that, which is where you might be really close to. In fact, I know Microsoft has done this other businesses as well. If you're in a, like within a mile of a Microsoft store and you're on this list of targeted people, they'll send you a coupon on your phone and say, or a text and say, hey, come into our store, you're really close. So those are some ways retailers are using some of this data. But the real power in this data is when we start combining them. So I talked about, you know, combining phone calls with location, but imagine when you start combining, you know, all of these different things. Like, for example, Facebook is partnering with a data broker called Axiom and Epsilon to match your online profile with in-store purchases. Because in the middle of all this, the real value is when you can kind of correlate the data, and that's what a data broker will do. They'll buy a data set from Facebook, they'll buy a data set from a credit card company, they'll buy a data set from Walgreens loyalty program, and then they'll combine it all together and match you. You know, they can basically create individual profiles. So then what these data brokers do is can sell lists. Okay, here's a list of people who are behind on their mortgage, and they'll sell that to a discount loan company. Or here's people who are going through a divorce. Or here's people with multiple sclerosis. Or you can imagine. And all of this data is very valuable to businesses in one way or another. In fact, most of us can be identified just as individuals by name with just 4 points of data on our time, date, and location. 95% of all Americans can be identified that way. And it actually if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. You know, if you consider where you work, where you live, that narrows the scope very, very narrowly to which people that can be. And you add a couple others in there, and then you can pretty quickly figure it out. So that's how they get the data. But the real value is for businesses is when these data sets are combined and correlated. So how do businesses access the data? Well, you can purchase data reports from these brokers. Like I mentioned, that's a whole industry in of itself. And that's what is called big data. And this is something you guys probably hear about in the world a lot, but in marketing as well. And big data is just this idea that there's so much data out there that can be combined and correlated in different ways. And you can buy that from brokers. That's a little bit outside of the scope of our class. But there are still ways that businesses can access some of this interesting data with the tools available to them. So small businesses or cash-strapped businesses that aren't interested in big data, they still have this powerful tools available to them to collect information on their customers. One of them is Google Analytics, which we're going to talk about today. And another is just the social platforms that people are using, so and some of the management tools. So Facebook, I showed you guys earlier in the semester what kind of analytics you can get on your audience if you are a page. You guys know that because you created an ad for the homework, the ad creation homework a while ago, that you can, as a business, target very specifically based on Facebook data. And then Hootsuite, which is a tool, if you'll remember from a couple lectures ago, where you can manage all your social media accounts from one platform. They also create data across platforms to tell you which of your posts are doing well, et cetera, et cetera. Which one has the biggest reach. So those are some tools that you can very easily use. So in this class, we're going to focus really on social platforms and Google Analytics, because even though big data is real and it's out there, I think in the next 5 years of your career, these are the tools that you'll most likely be using. So how do we make data meaningful? Well, first we have to kind of understand what kind of data is out there. And if you remember from very early in the semester, we read 2 chapters from the book Utility. One of them was on content marketing. One of those chapters was about measuring utility. And they talked about 4 different types of metrics in that chapter. I think some of these are obvious, but I'm going to walk you through them because it's important to kind of think about the different value you can get from each. And when you combine them, that's where a lot of interesting insight can come from. So the first kind of metric is consumption metrics. This is things like views on a post or views on a website, impressions, sessions, which is what Google Analytics calls people who visit your site, pretty much. Downloads, so if you have stuff, you know, how many people are downloading your music or your documents, whatever it is. So basically, it's just a number, you know, that tells you how many people saw, you know, came and saw, basically. Then there's advocacy and sharing metrics. One of the readings you guys did for social media lecture a couple lectures ago was about creating a weighted rating system for posts, and that looks like that helps you quantify your impact in social media. And they gave the example of, you know, somebody on Facebook knows that a share is worth the most because it will extend the reach of your post. So maybe, you know, for every share you get, you assign 10 points. For every comment a post gets, you give it 5 points. And for every like you get, you assign it 1 point. And that's how you come up with a quantifiable measure for basically sharing on social media. And I'll show you an example of a business that actually did that in a few slides. Then there's the third kind of metric is a lead generating metric. And these are should be pretty familiar to you at this point in the semester, but looking at the cost per lead, so figuring out how much it costs to bring in new people to your sales funnel or to your website. The conversion rate of those leads, so figuring out, you know, of the 100 people who come to our site, how many of them become a customer. Email subscription rates, because we know the power of email marketing. And lead source return on investment. So figuring out, and we'll be, you guys will understand this, I think, at a deeper level after we do our in-class activity, but is a lead from Facebook more engaged than a lead from Twitter or from email? And do they, you know, from a business perspective, do they spend more money? So figuring out which leads have the highest return on investment. And then the fourth type of metric is sales metric. And these, I think, should be familiar to you guys, but this is like how much a customer acquisition costs or user acquisition costs. How much does it cost to get them in? And when you're tracking campaigns, you can calculate that very easily. And when you combine acquisition costs with customer lifetime value, right, you can start to make decisions about targeting and segmenting like we've talked about in the HubSpot case. And finally, visitor value, you know, with a little bit of looking at some of these other metrics, you can say, okay, out of 100 visitors to our website, we know that this many become customers, let's say 20% or something, and then 20 become customers, and each customer is worth about $5, right? So that's 100, you make $100, this is very simple math for the point of illustration, but for every 100 customers, you get $100, so the visitor value generically in the beginning is $1 per visitor, right? Then as you learn a little bit more, maybe the Facebook leads, you know, as you calculate lead source URI, the people who are coming from Facebook spend twice as much. So their value is $2 and others are still, say, at $1. So with more data, you can start to calculate some of these things, which will help you make decisions going forward. So I want to give you guys a brief overview of Google Analytics. And I'll actually log into Google Analytics and show you what it looks like. And then we'll do some work with the data. So just by a show of hands, how many of you have ever used Google Analytics before? Okay, so a fair number of you. That's good. That'll be good when we get in groups. You can help each other out if you need it. Basically, Google Analytics is a suite of tools that tracks visitors to your website, what they do on your website, and then provides that data to you. And it's very simple to set up. You just have to copy some JavaScript or HTML from their, you know, they make it very, it's Google, so they make it very simple to use, and you just put this HTML or JavaScript in your web page, and then it's, this code phones home, as you know, you think about it that way, to Google every time the page is loaded, so every time somebody comes to the page. And it gives you a ton of information, so much, and you guys will see that in a minute, but some of the most valuable information is just statistics on your site, so who's visiting? Are they new? Are they old? It gives you information on bounce rates, which we'll talk about in a slide or two here. It also tells you where the traffic is coming from. So are a lot of people coming to your website from Facebook or from an article that a newspaper wrote about you? Or just you can figure out where the traffic is coming from. And then it gives you some incredible detail about the audience on your site, and you guys will see that as well. It's also very useful if you set up AdWords. Like with those paid search ads that we've talked so much about in this class, you can see very directly in Google Analytics which ad campaigns are working and which aren't. And finally, for search engine optimization, you can also see in Google Analytics which searches are resulting in people organically finding and landing on your page. So there is a ton of metrics that Google Analytics will give to you, but these seven are really the basics that as long as, you know, if you feel like you understand what these mean, you can dive in and really make some value, create some value out of the data. So I just want to go through these quickly, and then you'll also see these when we do the in-class exercise. So Sessions is basically the, you can define your date range. And this is the period of, you know, anytime someone is actively engaged with your website, it is a session. And so this can, you know, basically is when someone comes to your website and looks at it, that's a session. Now, if a person comes twice, that's counted as two sessions, right? So it's not necessarily number of users, but more, think of it, they used to call it visits, but now they call it sessions. Then there is number of users. So that's actually how many people have come to your website. So if you have a lot of, your sessions will always be greater or equal to the number of users. If you have a lot of return users, then you will see that in the gap of between those two. Now, how does Google know somebody's visited your website before? Well, they have cookies, right? So they embed cookies on your website or on your computer when you load a page with Google Analytics, and so they track you that way. So if I am looking at a website in my work computer, and then I go home and I look at it at my home computer, and I'm not logged into Google Chrome, say I use two different browsers, they won't know, Google won't know that it's the same visitor, so that would be counted as two visitors and two sessions. So that's the difference between sessions and users. Page views is how many pages on your website have been visited. Pages per session is the average number of pages that each session or visit result looked at, right? So if somebody looks repeatedly at a single page, those are counted twice. There's also average session duration, which is the average length of a session. And so this tells you how long they spent on your website. There's bounce rate. This is the percentage of visits that come to your site and then bounce without really interacting. So Google defines it as this, the percentage of single page visits, which is visits in which a person left your site from the page they came on, the entrance page, without interacting with the page. And then the percentage of new sessions, which is, you know, the percentage of people who are visiting that are first-time visitors. Any questions on these metrics? Okay. If you are really interested in Google Analytics and you want to learn more than what we cover in this class, here's a couple places you can do it. Google puts out tons of free videos at their Analytics Academy. And in fact, they offer like a you can get certified as a Google Analytics something expert. You just have to watch a bunch of videos, take some quizzes or tests. I really encourage you, if Google Analytics is something that you're interested in, it's a really great skill to have in the digital marketing world. It's a skill that's definitely in demand. And so, like, personally, during a stint of unemployment in my life, I watched a ton of Analytics Academy videos. I didn't get their certificate because I fortunately found some work before the end of that. But I did learn enough about Google Analytics that I was able to kind of start freelancing for Google, or not for Google, but for companies and helping them make sense out of their website visitors. So it's another way that you can, you know, it's a great skill to have just in general, but it's also something that you could possibly leverage into, you know, paid freelance work. And I'm always trying to help you guys make money. So another option is lynda.com. I think I've talked about that before. Those are great classes that are for free through the UW student. You just have to go to whisk.edu and search for Lynda, and you'll find those.